Welcome back, everyone, to Movie Geek and Proud, the show where there are no guilty pleasures in film. Fuck the haters and be proud of your taste. I'm your host, Rob, with another Rob's Rewind. This is where I rewatch a film in my collection and see if it holds up. To stay on the shelf, it has to score a 4 or above out of 5, or get tossed and traded for a store credit, figuratively anyway. Let's start the show.
The imagination of Jim Henson.
Who are you?
I've brought you a gift.
What is it?
It's a crystal. It'll show your dreams. There. It's further than you think.
The wizardry of George Lucas.
See? There's nothing to be afraid of.
She should have given up by now.
She must be stopped!
The excitement of David Bowie.
Everything I've done for you. I move the stars for no one. Run so long, run so far.
Three extraordinary talents take you to a world of fantasy and adventure. The world of Labyrinth.
Welcome to the first review of 2022. This is Movie Geek and Proud. I am your host, Rob. Here to help me with this review is Susie. She is here with us today to review Labyrinth. Hey, Susie.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Of course, of course. So this film is in my collection. This is sort of a Rob's Rewind. You know how this works. In my collection, I review a film by rewatching it. If I believe it deserves a 4 or above out of 5, it stays on my shelf. If it scores any lower than that, then it basically gets tossed in a bin, figuratively, and never seen again. Well, I can honestly tell you right away, this movie is staying on my shelf regardless of my score. This is one of my favorite movies of all time. I loved this film as a kid, and I just wanted to review this film in more of a celebration and just to dredge up conversation on how this film lives up from today. And honestly, to ask the question, can you remember the last line of the Labyrinth poem? Do you remember it? Because she completely forgets it every time. I find it to be a very easy line to remember, but you rewatched it, Susie. Do you remember the last line?
I think I do. The one she struggles with, and it's the most important one. And it's, should I say it, Rob? Am I okay?
Say it. No, do it. Do it. What is that line?
I believe it is, "You have no power over me."
Yes. I recently went to a outdoor screening of this. I believe it was for an anniversary. And so many like-minded, appropriate-aged adults came to this. And it was a joy. It was so great. This company who does a lot of this stuff kind of does these side things to kind of make it more festive. And so they had photo booths. They had this background setting of like sort of the desert right in before she goes into the castle or the labyrinth, excuse me. And you can just take photos, but they also had separate photo booths. It was great. So I went with some friends, and me and a friend of mine actually went up because we tried to do something different. We didn't want to dress in costumes or anything cosplay. But what we did is we took our hands and we formed one of the faces in the Helping Hands tunnel. It was so cool. And the photographer was like, "I see what you're doing. That's so cool." And apparently nobody done it, but I felt pretty proud of myself.
That's awesome.
So before we get your opinion on the film, did you like it before rewatching it? Is this something that you rewatched, or is it just a movie you remember and you're just like, okay, yeah, that was a good one? What's your relationship with Labyrinth?
So I was really excited when you invited me to review this one, Rob, because it is a movie that I really, really loved as a kid. So I was born in 83 and it came out in 86.
86.
And I think that I really kind of saw it quite close to that date, like 5 or 6 years old, and really, really passionately loved it as a child. But I feel similar to the character herself. You know, I have forgotten it quite a bit. So I was very eager to rewatch this because I remember pieces like a kid would, but not the holistic movie.
Yeah, yeah. There were moments, you know, throughout, you know, my adulthood is when they would, you know, just kind of show it on screen. This isn't the first time that I've seen it, like, on screen. Of course, when I was a kid, I watched it at home, but it was always a joy to always rewatch it. And it obviously became a cult classic for many different reasons. In fact, there was one year on my literal birthday to the day, they had a what is called a sing-along and quote-along. So not only were you prompted to sing with the movie, but there were specific quotes where they would put the captions on the screen for you to yell out. So it was a joy to, again, experience the movie in a different way with like-minded people. And we definitely took advantage of all of that. And it was just so, like, real quick, if you can remember, like, one quote out of the movie that just stands out to you, what quote from the movie do you remember?
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, in many respects, it is kind of just the speech that you have no power over me, because one of the things as a little girl is there's this very specific sort of voice Jennifer Connelly's character has, this sort of stilted way that I remember when playing pretend, I would always try to talk like her. It's like this, you know, and so when she announces these, when she quotes the book, it's in such a theatrical way. And of course, as a child, that's what you're stuck with, right? You remember those things that I used to walk around the house, like saying that to my parents, you have no power over me and you have no power over me. And that just sticks out so much for me line wise. I think the other thing, Rob, that sticks out is the music.
Amazing, amazing. Yeah, David Bowie usually has a lot of the quotable stuff, of course. You know, there's when he's pretending to be a beggar in the tunnel and, you know, he's like, what's going on here? And then Huggle goes, nothing. And he's like, nothing, nothing, tra-la-la. I don't, like, just little stuff like that just makes me laugh. But again, you watch everybody watching this film and that's just one of the things that kind of stands out. You're just like, that's a quote to kind of remember and recite, because it's just, it means nothing, but it just stands out because it's David Bowie, right?
Well, that's totally the thing. So I must say that part of when I was thinking through how we were going to talk about this today and really sort of where my head was at, so much of this experience for me was saying things like, wow, this movie felt longer when I was younger and more kind of bigger and more epic. And also the funniest thing, Rob, is I had this weird belief that there were multiple like top hit songs from this that as soon as I'd hear them, I'd start singing them. But what I'm really realizing now as I'm rewatching this is that as an adult, you're really watching it for David Bowie and his one song. And you're as the adult, you're just like kind of following him on screen. Like the puppets and all of that is cute, but you could tell that's really geared for the kids. And David Bowie is the mantelpiece for adult watching of The Labyrinth. And I have to say this, I did look up how old he was at the time of this, and I still can't believe that. Like, I think as a kid, David Bowie is just frozen at like 50 years old or something in my mind. But he was like 38 or 39 when he filmed that, which
is crazy. So
crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy. Well, we're on the topic of David Bowie. Let's point out, like, so this, the one thing that I heard about this movie is that he was not necessarily the first choice for this, right? And the only other person that I had heard about was Michael Jackson. And I think it makes complete sense why he was almost casted for this movie. I mean, he has a labyrinth in his backyard. I mean, this is sort of, especially if they were going to make it a musical. However, I did read that also Prince Sting and Mick Jagger was thought about for this movie. And the fact that they went with David Bowie also changed sort of the course and sort of like outline of this movie. At first, we weren't supposed to see anything in the center of the castle, especially his lair or him, you know, just hanging out with the goblins at all, until she made it into the center of the labyrinth. So it was supposed to be her journey, who she meets, and then we see the Goblin King at the very end. But because it was Bowie, they were like, we got to change this and make it so he has as much screen time as possible, which I think also included just giving him more of a visual soundtrack than just mm-hmm. having his music in the background. And I found that really interesting. But what would you have thought if anybody else was cast for this?
Yeah, well, so it's kind of interesting that you say that, because in my mind, I mean, Mick Jagger or Sting, I think would probably have, I mean, but Prince or Michael Jackson too. I mean, when you list out all those people, in my mind, I'm like, all of those people would warrant a lot of screen time, right? I mean,
I thought so too.
The one differentiation, though, when you were listing those, Rob, that really stood out to me, and I'm curious what you think, is I thought, especially on rewatch, that Bowie had a sort of sexuality layer. He was or sort of like a sexual layer to this that is a little bit like there's also her innocence and virginity sort of layer to this. And it's right. And I've read some pieces on that there's interpretations of him. It's more of like a tempting her type of thing. And I do think that, to be quite frank, Michael Jackson had less of, I mean, maybe in 88, he still had some of the Thriller sex appeal, but his sort of sex appeal waned some. And I feel like it would be maybe more like the Oz type of the Wiz, right? Like it would be more, maybe they would remove that angle of the relationship, because I think he had more of a kid-friendly element versus Bowie was definitely known as like a sexy androgynous figure that was, I don't know. I hope I articulated that well, but I definitely see a different movie with Michael Jackson than I see with David Bowie or Mick Jagger, because Mick Jagger is all sex too, right? I mean, he is.
Yeah. Well, I think that's kind of where the script and everything kind of came into play when it was about Bowie. I think you're absolutely right. There is a definite difference in having a film with Michael Jackson. There is more of a kid-like, you know, playful thing to it. You know, I'm thinking more of like Never Ending Story, where it might be a little bit lighter. And I think Labyrinth is the lightest movie out of all of them, but I think what you were saying about the sexual aspect of it, that is something I don't think Michael would have accomplished, especially in chemistry with Jennifer. So it made sense for Bowie to take on that if this is where they wanted the story to go. And he's, mm-hmm. you know, easier on the eyes. I think Prince would have accomplished that too, but I don't know if Jennifer would have been a right girl to pair with Prince.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with like color or anything like that. It's just, no, I don't see the two together. So, but my thing is that if I were to think about how the others would work, I'm just thinking more of the soundtrack. And I would love a Labyrinth soundtrack with Prince, to be honest. I think that would have been amazing to have.
Oh, I completely agree. And I have to say, the reason I was laughing when you were talking about their chemistry was not because of anything other than I didn't actually imagine Prince at first. I imagined Fred Armisen from SNL playing Prince. And I was like, how would they even film that? He'd be like hiding behind everything in his weird little ways. And I'm like, Susie, that's not actually Prince. That's Fred Armisen playing Prince.
Right. Yeah. See, now I look at that and I think Dave Chappelle, when he was Prince on the Chappelle Show, and that would have been a movie for the times.
The last scene would have been them having pancakes, clearly,
right? Yeah. Exactly. So what did you think of Labyrinth watching it again?
Okay, so I still think it's a lovely, lovely film, and I think that if I had children, I would absolutely bring this out as a classic for them to watch. I don't know as an adult how often I'll meander over to Netflix and revisit it myself. I think I was so young when I loved it that the nostalgia is slightly different than something I loved like in high school, you know, where I could still devour some of those things. But I think it's a very childhood lockbox for me. Like, and so it was wonderful to revisit, but I have to say I watched it and it was more of kind of a nostalgic walkabout than I think it was me kind of being like, oh, I'm going to watch this every year like I do with Serendipity or something like that. Now, having said that, there are a couple of things that stood out. One was the practical effects are phenomenal.
Amazing. They still hold up so well. It's insane. Yes, I totally agree.
Yeah. In fact, I would actually have said they should have done less of that digital stuff because that's where it looks bad. The one scene that looks bad is when she's dancing with the things and it's all the bog stuff. So that was really my takeaway of I kind of started to watch it from a skill set level of like, I'm enjoying this, but it is a little bit of a kid movie. And so I started looking at the sets and how they were doing it and the puppetry. And I was like, this movie is phenomenal in that sense. And so for me, it was just a fantastic, solid rewatch. And I will obviously watch it again. But I think, like, Rob, I'd love to the next time we're hanging out, let's, you know, watch it with somebody that I can enjoy it with, too.
No, that totally makes sense. I would say that I just continue to repeat this movie over again without losing its touch is because it does give you an opportunity to sort of be a kid again watching this kind of stuff. And the movie, I think, doesn't take itself too seriously, but it still has this like hint of adult in it. I don't know if there's a better word for it, but I don't know. There's just something about it that it's not like you're watching Power Rangers again or anything like that. Like, it gives you enough of that kid-like essence while not losing the fact that you are of age and you're watching a kid's movie or whatever. I think there's just a very nice mix of everything that you would want to be able to continue to watch it as an adult and still enjoy it for many different reasons, right? But I'm a kid at heart, and anytime that I play this movie, it really just allows me to have that heavy wonder. It's just like for that generation who loved Alice in Wonderland or, you know, The Wizard of Oz, which there's tons of comparisons with that. But for me, this was like another, you know, film that kind of reminded me of Wizard of Oz and just had more of that like horror aspect to it, a little bit of that heavy, you know, like monster element that I tend to enjoy. So I don't watch this movie every year, but I know that if there is like an outdoor screening and somebody wants to, like, I will 100% not without a doubt go. Like, that's just how I see this movie. I still think that it holds up again with the practical effects. I think Bowie fans will enjoy his youthful look and what he did. And also, I think that anybody who grew up with the Muppets in general will always appreciate Jim Henson. Just seeing his name, It just seems like you're a part of this club that I think a lot of this, like today's generation, will never really understand. Unlike how amazing this man was on creating worlds and characters just for kids, and that we got to be a part of growing up with something like this. It just hits different than CGI and all that movie magic stuff that's out there. The practical effects and just having it accomplished through almost a 90-minute movie, I just think is so cool. And
I agree.
You're just reminded of that kind of stuff. Maybe all of this is just another word for nostalgia, but at the same time, I do feel like, you know, a kid again sometimes when I watch it, and that's a good feeling.
I agree. And, you know, I think, you know, to also what you were saying too about it being a nice treat for Bowie fans, I did have that moment where, you know, I sometimes forget he's passed away, and it is such an interesting piece of his. And I also think it's interesting to see just how fucking cool David Bowie is for always pushing all these different boundaries and doing it cool and in a way that he could end up in a Jim Henson kids movie in 1988 wearing literally like stiletto boots. I'm like, Live your life, David Bowie. I am right? here for this.
I mean, there are people today still cosplaying his outfit. There is a masquerade ball that they do every year here in LA. It's a 2-day event, and you know, you're supposed to go there kind of dressed in the same wear that they were in her dream. And so people still talk about this movie today. And I don't know how much this movie kind of goes around in your wheelhouse as far as like just being mentioned in your circle of group of friends or on social media. But most of the time, if I ever hear about this movie again, it's really because of the costumes and the bulge and all of this stuff. Like that stuff just stands out all the time. And they always remind it, but it's the hair and, you know, obviously the dance magic is always something to think about. I've even heard it a couple of times in karaoke. So, I mean, people still talk about this movie, I think, today. I actually liked the soundtrack of this too. While that song stands out, all the other songs, especially the opening number, I think is really great. And I like how it's just within the credits. You are finding out right away, this is a David Bowie film. You are going to get a lot of screen time with him, as well as hearing this man's voice through the soundtrack. I mean, it's just right away.
Oh, yeah.
But I do like that opening number. And then, you know, we meet Sarah, and she's, 16, maybe 18? I don't know how old this woman is.
She's got to be. I took her as more 14 or 15.
Oh, younger 15. Than that. Okay.
Yeah, because I think so. And then it was interesting too. You know, I was thinking about growing up, I had a younger brother too. And of course, this was top of mind when he was crying. Like, how can I give my little brother away to a goblin king too? Was part of it. But you know what else is that? We haven't mentioned this before, Rob, but as you were talking through those pieces of just the nostalgia and all, and I was thinking about how I'd have my, you know, if I had kids, I'd have them watch today. One of the things that struck me is Jim Henson and that sort of Muppet world also could pull off dark themes in ways that I don't think we always challenge kids with some of those things anymore. We protect them too much. And yes. There's some real things in that movie that are, you know, like rewatching that scene where they're taking their heads and limbs off. I remember, oh my God, this scared me as a kid. But that's how you as a kid get brave. I remember The Labyrinth was the first one that when we started to, it made me a better player as a child. Like I would go over to Lisa Kovkowski's house in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, and we'd play Labyrinth and we'd run around and play. And it taught kids how to imagine and explore. I mean, I think what I've realized is just how much Labyrinth and Sesame Street and things like that played into my ability to learn, play, and imagine. And I'm grateful for you, Jim Henson.
So real quick, I guess since you brought that up, I just want to get your opinion about some of the other movies that are very similar to this. But like, for instance, with Neverending Story, like that movie, I mean, that movie teaches you about death because of, you know, Atreyu's horse, Artax. And like that scene will get me every single time. But how do you do that to a child? You know,
I wouldn't know.
Because you never saw. Whoa. You have to watch this movie. I'm very surprised by that. Well, I was going to ask you what your thoughts were as far as like ranking sort of these four heavy films that are kind of surrounded on this childlike dark sense. And in addition to Labyrinth, there's Legend with Tom Cruise and Tim Curry, The Dark Crystal, which was turned into a series. I never saw Dark Crystal fully, nor the series as well. And then there's Neverending Story, which I think is the biggest of them all as far as franchise. And, Neverending Story was insanely dark.
Yeah. I would say though, so I think where I fall with that though is probably, you know how some households have certain movies, like you are either this household or that household or certain things. So Neverending Story kind of never circulated my household, but Willow did. And I feel like
Willow's the other one. Yes. Okay.
And so
Willow's the other one.
For me, it was definitely Willow, Legend, and Labyrinth.
Okay.
And then there's another one that I can't think of right now. And I'm this is so amazing. I'm having this unlock memory. And I think it's one of the Monty Python guys.
Okay.
But it's like a baron. And there's like a there's like tons of famous people in this. And it's like the same way of weird. It's sort of got the same vibe of these 80s fantasy films. And they like travel around on a ship. And there's a baron, and it might be Terry Gilliam. We'll have to look it up after. But I'm
yes.
But anyway, because I know people listening are like, oh my god, stop, or they're screaming out the name of the movie. But
yeah,
I do have to add. Then I will have to add Dark Crystal and Never Ending Story. I find Legend to be very adult. I find Willow to be very adult, and Labyrinth slightly less so. So I think there's that's sort of my journey. Is like I went Labyrinth, then Willow, then Legend, and Legend's the one that. When everything goes dark, like when the beautiful unicorn and all that stuff happens, that's always been like the scariest scene for like as a kid. I was terrified.
I'll definitely have to rewatch. So Legend was played in my house the most because of my brother. And then Labyrinth was more of a self-discovery with me and just falling in love with it. As far as Dark Crystal, that just never crossed sort of in our home, and I just never really watched it. Willow was definitely another favorite of mine, and you know they're making a series on Disney Plus.
Yes, like,
it's a direct sequel. I cannot wait for it. It's going to be great. So yeah, Dark Crystal is something that I will need to catch up on. But yes, definitely watch Neverending Story when you can. I want to get your opinion about Sarah. So first of all, Jennifer Connelly, my goodness, she still looks exactly the same today. I think like her and Paul Rudd will live and outlive us all, right? After we've all perished, those two will be the only ones living and become the new Adam and Eve. I swear to you, they will be left to populate the earth because they are never dying. I don't understand how these two have managed to look the same. But yes, there is a clear difference with her in 86, and she looks super young. But what do you think about this woman's character?
I mean, I think she does a very, very good job, I think, of playing that sort of, you know, female protagonist of that age role. She does a good job. You know, I tell you this is because I really disliked her at the beginning. And the fact that she could get me on her side by the end and like super rooting for her and thinking that she's just wonderful is like, that's, she did what was necessary, right? As the character went on a journey that was convincing for me, the viewer, that I came around to, she's not a spoiled little brat. She's wonderful now. So I think I think if you're the, you know, back then, if you were looking at Jennifer Connelly there, you're going, that woman's going to be huge. This young woman is going to go somewhere. That sounds so stereotypical. I'm like, this little lady's going places in the world. But I mean, totally right. I mean, she clearly is a young woman just nailing this, in my opinion. And she holds her own against David Bowie. I'm like, she just told David Bowie to fuck off, basically. So
yeah. Yeah, no, I
she's
told,
got this.
Well, so in the beginning, you know, we see her of, you know, in this teenage age, they kind of establish that she doesn't necessarily have too much of a social life. She lives in her world of fantasy. Her room is just decked out with it. And she does come off as pretty spoiled and entitled. She's a little dramatic. The exchange with her wicked stepmother, I mean, clearly we find out that her mom had passed away. And I think a lot of this is just kind of holding on to her sort of ideals on you know, like plays and theater and just that fantasy world that her mom lived in. That's just kind of how I read her, is that she just doesn't want to grow up because she's still kind of mourning about her mom. And it was just the way that she was kind of like all over her room. And so that's kind of how I took it. And then the dad just obviously just moved on, had another baby. The baby obviously is just like a symbol of like, oh, he just has a new family. So they don't necessarily get along as well. But yeah, I did see her as very entitled and just a little weird. Because she she would be like, oh my God, Dad, go away. I don't want to talk to you. And then he's like, okay, peace. I'm going to dinner. And she's like, you practically broke down the door to talk to me. I mean, I'm like, woman, what do you want here? Like, but I mean, I get it. It's just kind of how
the way that she, there's another, I know exactly what you're talking about. And she also does one where she's like, maybe he really did want to talk to me.
Yeah.
The way she says it. And it's so, it is the way little, well, so I want to be careful here because I recognize I'm stereotyping, you know, your listeners need to know I'm a 38-year-old woman. So when I was growing up, it was, you know, little girls, you know, and there's like there's this sort of, you know, when you're just so dramatic, you know, you could just tell the way everything is like, you know, put your hand up and get the smelling salts. And she's putting, you're right, she's mimicking the mother's sort of theatrics. And it's so something I did. I used to watch like Gone with the Wind as a kid. And I'd be like, you know, run into the kitchen and I'd say to my mom, like, you know, fiddle dee dee, like the character says.
Yeah.
And my mom is like, I'm sorry, you're not a Southern Belle. Go make your bed. Okay, go make your bed. And I just think she encapsulated that so well, Rob. Like, it's so silly. But I feel like as a kid, we were probably like, oh my God, I get her. And now as an adult, you're like, oh, she is so dramatic, just like a kid her age would be.
So the labyrinth itself, which is its own character, I think the idea of a labyrinth is so much fun, but that's also just due to the fact of like solving a big puzzle, which I love puzzles. And just running this labyrinth, I think would be so much fun to do. With all the characters that Sarah comes in contact with, like, does any of them stand out? Do you have any favorites? Was there a certain part of the labyrinth that you like? Tell me about like what you enjoyed or even disliked about sort of going through the labyrinth.
I mean, I remember I've always, the hands thing has always stood out to me as something that's very upsetting. That's actually a much shorter scene on rewatch. In my mind, that's like embedded as like the longest stretch of time, which is a testament to that. So I think that's a part of the labyrinth I enjoy because I think it's very well done as a kind of a scary part. I think that's one thing about the labyrinth is it's a good balance of kind of characters you'd want to meet along the way. I think my favorite part though is the, this is just the best part of the whole movie is that little caterpillar.
Oh, we're going to go there. We're going there. Okay, so
you
Jared.
You asked me what I liked.
Yes, you did.
The labyrinth, and that is the best part.
Okay, so Jareth, you know, he's the villain of this film. But let's talk about the actual villain of this movie, and it's that goddamn blue-haired caterpillar. Fuck her. Fuck that caterpillar. No, I think it's a he. Or, I don't know. Fuck that caterpillar. I'm like, this whole movie is due to that goddamn caterpillar. And I don't know where the allegiance is on why he needed to do that. It was just the most fucked up thing.
It was hilarious. I loved it so much. And I was like, this is amazing. This is my favorite part. It, hands down. That was great. I mean, the labyrinth itself I think it's quite well done. You know, it reminds me a little bit of Princess Bride when you get to the Bog of Stench, and I'm not sure which came first. That's the one piece where I feel like all these movies always have to have some sort of stinky moat that sucks you in. There's always got to be something like that. Yeah, I think all that's great. My only thing is what I've said already, which is that they could have just gone without CGI, or, you know, it's not CGI at that time, but special effects. I think they would have been better off just sticking with practical effects. You can see some of that, right? When she's running down the labyrinth, you can see a little bit, if you're looking closely, that it's actually painting of the rest of the path.
Yes.
So you can see how they're playing with those.
Yeah.
I love that, Rob.
Yes.
I mean, I think the labyrinth is cool because of the practical ways in which they made it work. That's the stuff I would actually go and rewatch it tonight to just kind of even hone in more on where I think they're using certain components that are kind of unique to that labyrinth.
I, I think that's great. I mean, right from the beginning, the labyrinth fucks with you. Like, you're just walking in a straight line. That is it. Like, you have to step out of your head and really just let yourself go and just think outside of the box, because that's the only way you're going to solve this thing. It was literal tests to see if she could do it. And, you know, God bless her, but oh, too bad. Just too bad. Like, if she had just really walked that. Look, anytime I play a video game, I always go left. No matter what, I don't care what fork I'm looking at, even if it looks the dangerous way possible, I always go left. And that's what you should do, because you might get straight to the end.
It's so funny.
So I really like the helping hands. I just like, who thinks of shit like that, to have a tunnel full of hands that communicate through hand puppet? Yeah. Like, that is just amazing. But like, I really, really enjoyed the two doors. One lies, one tells the truth. That's what I'm thinking about.
That's the one. That's the one where they're
yeah, they're, it's the red and blue door. Yeah, I know you were talking about the knockers. No, the knockers are great. No, but the oh, you know what? I think Return to Oz is also in that bunch of films that I was thinking about. I don't know why it just popped in my head. Okay, anyways, but the blue and red door. So that is an old school riddle. I've heard this riddle many different ways. There was a guy with a fork on a road. One goes to cannibals, one goes to salvation. Like, I've heard so many different ways of, like, ask one question, one tells a lie, one always tells the truth. And do you happen to understand the riddle when it's told to you? Like, I've heard this a couple of times. It makes sense now, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's for the most, yeah. I mean, I follow the logic, right? I mean, it's like, if this is true, but this is also true, then that means this has to be a lie. It's that,
yeah.
There's kind of variations of that. I do like that. And also thinking about that, that is kind of a little bit of a known riddle, which would make sense as a children's film. You're sort of introducing kids to these well-known, everybody's got to hear something for the first time somewhere. Right. And I think many of us learned that riddle from that movie, which, by the way, since you had just mentioned The Return to Oz, I did remember, it's called The Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Okay. It
was Terry Gilliam, who's from he was an original Monty Python guy, but the woman that's in it that I think I was trying to remember, it's Uma Thurman's very early role.
Wow. Like,
she's in that. It's a 1988 movie. You should check that one out, Rob, if you haven't, because I think it's like this. It's got Robin Williams, Eric Idle. It's got Sarah Polley, Jonathan Pryce.
Wow.
Yeah. And I just love that we're talking about this, because that memory of that movie was buried so deep in my brain. I don't know what would have unlocked it, but The Labyrinth and this conversation most certainly did. And now I have a movie to watch this weekend for Christmas.
That is what MGP is all about. Yeah, a lot of these rooms these locations were pretty cool. I like sort of the idea of the oubliette, you know, a place to just store things to forget about them. Just the movement and way the labyrinth worked anyway. Those little like creatures who would change the directions of the boards, like everything, like to the smallest detail, I think was used in this. And
I'm picturing that one little one that flips it over and then he like yells a bunch of expletives at her, and I'm just cracking up.
I thought that I wrote down what he said, and it was, I think he called her like, your mother's an aardvark or something. That's what I got out of the captions. I was like, oh, is that what they say?
it was hilarious. And you know, as we're talking about that, as you're listing off the characters, and you know, there's also the like little old ladies that try to get her to go to her room and trick her into that. I wanted to share, I was prior to us talking about this, reading a couple different fan theories. And one really hones in on this idea of Jareth sort of trying to entice her, almost like the to the point where like the first gift he gives her turns into a serpent, like very biblical references. And even somebody on Salon wrote up that like the oublier, you know, oublier en français is to forget. So that's actual French word, right, with the root meaning of to forget. And so they were even saying like Jareth was, that could be like a metaphor for him trying to get her a little drunk. Same with like the actual like poisoning of her and all the way through. And obviously when she says you have no power over me, there could be that sort of connotation too. But I say all this, Rob, because if you follow that theory, they were saying that the older women in all of this sort of clutter are Jareth's like previous women he's like sloughed off.
Okay. So that's why we see. So it's just this junkyard of all his past conquests. He's obviously done this before. And I've never thought about that. That is interesting.
It's probably going too deep on it. And that's why I didn't want to like lead with that being a big conversation piece. But as we were sort of talking through the characters, I thought that was interesting. I mean, I think movies are up for interpretation. And if you can, especially something old, right? Because listen, Me Too movement wasn't around during Labyrinth or some of the things that go on today. And good art that's created at a given time can always be brought to the current time and meaning be found in it. So I'm sort of trying to look at it that way. Not that I'm trying to say to everybody, Jim Henson was trying to write a story about consent and all these things. No, of course not. He was writing it. But I think it's a beautiful thing when you can find meaning in art that maybe was unintended. So I thought I'd share that.
No, I think that's a really good insight. The only thing that I got from that scene was that it was another sort of last attempt to keep her from growing up. Like, we want to keep you in this childlike state. We don't want you to really realize what it is that you're doing. But it was also sort of a metaphor for her to kind of let some of this childhood stuff go, maybe even move on from her mother. Because she says this line, she's like, I'm remembering that I am searching for something. And then she looks around, she goes, this is all junk. Like, I'm finally kind of growing out of all of this stuff, and I should not be so, I mean, because this whole thing started because somebody took my Lancelot. Like, she needs to kind of let some of this stuff go and grow up a little bit. Not to say that she needs to be more like her stepmother and go out on dates and, you know, stuff like that. But at the same time, like, it's okay to kind of like move on, right? That's kind of the only thing that I kind of got out of that. I would say that when I was a kid, most of my least favorite parts were just that whole ballroom masquerade scene. I mean, right now, if I were to watch it, it's a beautiful song. And I like when he sings it. But I kind of just get like, whatever. It's just like this party of like weird people. Like, I just really didn't get it. I kind of understand it now as I'm watching it a little bit more. And I do appreciate just sort of like he's really into her, I think. You know, even if it is for possession, I mean, he kind of goes back and forth with it, like, do everything I say and I'll be your slave. Like, it's just this back and forth with him. Yeah, exactly.
That line, I was like, well, and honestly, Rob, in that same vein, do you interpret the last scene of him still being outside there of like, let me put it this way. She's clearly, this is a parable for her growing up. And I agree to your point that she's looking around and she's like, it's all junk. The other thought I had about it though, was that it's all a facade, right? Like it starts like you can't, I guess the message is that no matter what she does, like she can create a fake room and live in it and hold her teddy bear, but you grow up. It's not a choice. Like there is no choice here. And I felt like that was almost some of it too. And almost like, was he also waiting outside for her maybe to tempt her again or something? There was something there about just the fact that he's still, like you were saying, he's so in love with her. He's still like hanging out her window at the end.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about that. I don't know why I'm stuttering. I'm sort of torn between what exactly this movie sort of entailed as far as her and her mental state. So when I say that, let's look at Wizard of Oz. Let's look at Alice in Wonderland and then Labyrinth. Out of those films, which one was a dream? Which one was in her head? Which ones were real? Which ones do we want to be real? Like, I don't know if Labyrinth actually happened, to be honest with you. And I'm still thinking about it, just the way that she kind of called back her friends and the way that they appeared. And then also that even the goblins were sort of like in the room with her, even though they were the villains. So it's just like, and here's the other thing. Her room was complete, total Kaiser Soze. Everything in the labyrinth was in her room. So it it just kind of prompts this idea that it was all in her head rather than it actually being a real place. Because, like, I'm telling you, everything from David Bowie, literal David Bowie, down to the shattering machine. You know that machine that was like twirling in the tunnel and about to kill them? That was on her wall. Like, I just noticed that in this latest rewatch. I'd never noticed that drawing. And then, like, David Bowie, the person, acted with his mom. There's a picture of him on her mirror. And there's, so like, it's like,
puppets are all on. So, like, all of the characters are somewhere in the room.
Yes.
And, I mean, obviously that, I mean, this is, for me, this one isn't a question. For me, it's sort of like, it's got to be a dream, and it's her sort of, it's her processing of it, like her imagination. And one thing I thought about it too was, you know, as a kid, it's like Santa Claus. Okay, so at some point, I knew he didn't exist. No matter, I mean, there was this. My parents over-indexed to make me believe. Like, they definitely went out of their way to make sure that the Santa thing lived on. And there was certainly an age where I was like, this isn't real. But did you ever have that, Rob, where you were still like, but maybe.
Oh, of course. Oh, of course. Maybe. Of course. And
I feel like the labyrinth stuff, when she was like, they were like, we'll still be here when you need us. It's like they will fade over time, sort of thing. But yeah, you, even when you've resolved to grow up, you still, there's still imagination times for a while, or where you were like still hoping that you could still. I mean, I did this with Labyrinth and Peter Pan. I still like believe that someday I would like fly away to another land. Yeah, it's a little depressing actually, now that we're talking about it. And I felt a little depressed watching it last night, because I was like, oh yeah, I'll never have imagination quite like this again.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, just thinking about that, I mean, hopefully she doesn't lose all of it. And I think that's, you know, if you need us, if you need to kind of revert back and all of it, like, that totally makes sense. But I never sort of made this decision of if it was real, because the owl being outside definitely would suggest that some of it had to have been real. By the way, that owl is beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
I wrote down sort of what that species was. I thought I wrote it down. Sorry. It was called a white barn owl, I think that's what I read. And it's beautiful, beautiful owl. I love that owl. And makes sense that he would be sort of like this, like, familiar like character to, you know, turn into or whatnot. But yeah, just down to her books, A Wizard of Oz, Alice in Wonderland, all of the stuff on her shelf. She even had the topsy-turvy stairs poster on her wall. Like, all of it was present in this imagination. So to me, I always thought that it was all in her head.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't get the whole Wizard of Oz thing until a little later, with the fact of how many people she actually met on her journey, taking them with her or whatnot. So that all fit. The Huggle thing, he also goes by Hugwort, Hedgewort, Higgle. I've heard everybody kept getting his name wrong. This character, so depressed, so low self-esteem. Like, I want to say that he was there for a lesson, but like, he was a very self-deprecating character. It was interesting to have him in this, where it felt like it was sort of his movie too. But I just felt bad. I just wonder if there was a lesson in there somehow about friendship or anything like that. But he really hated himself. And just watching him cower to like Bowie and everything was like really sad.
I mean, for me, I sort of took it as if this is her imagination, then the characters are manifestations of her own feelings.
So
I kind of took it as he's the most complex character because he's sort of the, will she betray herself in this journey and not do the right thing? He sort of represented in some respects, I think, kind of her doubt around that and her, and then when he could overcome it, she also overcame it. And I thought that was kind of very well done in many respects. And so the other two characters are sort of the, you know, the parts of her personality that are, or, you know, parts of her supporting the part of her that questions it. So that's a bit of how I took it. But, you know, also I said to myself, this is also a show for kids. So they're just teaching them lessons. And this was a lesson about honesty and a lesson about, you know, not lying and doing the right thing.
Oh my God. Lancelot, the dog, when he comes back in as Ambrosius, like first of all, I don't know why it took me forever to realize that that was her dog. Like everything else is in her head. Why not her dog in this film? And man, Ambrosius is my spirit animal. I don't care what anybody says. That dog knew to mind his own business. And when you hear a gunfire, you run the other way and you ask questions later. He took off. He just knew better. I do not fuck around with shit that does not mean anything to me. And like, he was like, I'm going this way. Sir Didymus is like, the battle's behind us. You're going the wrong way. Spirit animal. That's just me. I stay in my lane and that's how I do it.
I love it. And you know, you can kind of see a similarity between Hoggle jumping and landing face first when he does his big grand gesture, and then later what does she do? She takes a leap of faith as well, and this time it works. And so I think there's actually supposed to be something there, which is sometimes when you do something brave you end up with bumps and bruises, and sometimes a leap of faith is what it takes to get to the next step. So I saw a parallel in those two scenes.
The other thing that I noticed throughout this movie, they didn't talk about it too much towards the end, but it could be implied. But in the beginning, they kept saying that Sarah takes a lot of things for granted. And I don't think I really understood exactly what that meant, just in the context of how they were pointing it out to her. I mean, Huggle had just met her and he was already like, you know, your problem. You take too many things for granted. And so I like looked up what it meant so I can really get a explanation. So there's two things. It says to accept without question or objection. And I'm assuming that's why she just assumed the labyrinth was just this one straight line. And you know, even the caterpillar told her, you take things for granted, don't take things for granted. And then it was like too lightly to fail to properly notice or appreciate. So like, was that a theme like throughout the movie that I just missed? Okay. I'm trying to think of other ways of where they were talking about it, but I didn't really pinpoint exactly when she was doing that.
I thought it was supposed to be about the fact that she takes for granted the fact that she does have a stepmother who wasn't evil, by the way. If you watch that scene closely, she's quite wonderful, nice, and trying to bring her into the fold, and they want her to be around her brother, and some, you know, family is important. And I think that the reason that she was imagining it, the lesson being taught, was that she's, you know, acting like this entitled, spoiled little brat and not realizing that she has all this, you know, all these people here to support and love her, and she's willing to go throw it all away and wish her brother away to a goblin king, little brat. She does take things for granted.
Right. Well, as wonderful as this film is, I just want to say there was two other facts that I kind of found interesting. Was this movie went through 25 different treatments and rewrites, including George Lucas, a woman named Laura Phillips, Elaine May, with Terry Jones having the final say on the script, but it went through all of these people. Also, because the movie was a flop and definitely didn't even earn its budget back, like, according to Brian Henson, like, Jim Henson sort of went into this heavy depression over it, and he never really directed a full-length film again after that. So this is pretty much his only thing, within a bunch of, like, shorts and episodes of, like, Sesame Street and things like that. The other thing that I found interesting, and I'm sure you know this, a lot of people, I think, know this but don't talk about it as much, is that David Bowie, he does not juggle those crystal balls like you think he does. There is an actual human being under that huge cape of his doing all of that choreography with the crystals. It's a man named Michael Motion, who did it without even looking at what he was doing. He was standing directly behind Bowie the whole time, just sticking his arms under his armpits to play his hands the way he was moving those crystals. Did you know that? That was not Bowie.
I did not.
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, so even when he's standing in the window looking out and he's taking one at a time as he's juggling it with the other hand and blowing it away, that's not him. That is this gentleman, Michael.
Oh, that's interesting. See, now I'm probably going to go back on what I said, and I might have to do some more rewatches, because, like, you know, Rob, you've probably picked up on this as we review, as you invite me to graciously invite me to review movies with you, is I've really come to have a deeper and richer appreciation of the how the movie is made, or
yes,
like I look at a lot more of the effects stuff, and I don't know, it's a kind of a cool way to start watching. And that's what I really appreciated about this rewatch. And now that you're telling me these extra things, I might have to do it one more time.
Man, okay, so go on YouTube. I'm pretty sure there's a video of a behind the scenes of the guy doing the whole thing while Bowie's just kind of standing there doing his line. I think it's on there, so I would definitely look that up. But with that being said, did you have like a definite rating that you would give this?
Yeah, you know, listen, Rob, I actually am going to go with a 4 out of 5 on it, because I just feel that from a pure, you know, watchability, would I recommend this to others? Is this something that should stay in my, I'll call my library, right? I love your criteria so much for that. And so I'm sort of applying similar criteria. And yet this one stays in the, it might not make it out once a year, but it definitely is in my official repertoire of a solid, great, nostalgic film I'd love to share, you know, with others. So 4 out of 5 for me.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, I'm giving it a solid 4 as well. I think the movie did age well. I still recommend it to people. And of course, I still rewatch it. As much imagination and world that we were introduced to in this movie, I think they're obviously, you know, watching it today, we probably would want a little bit more. And so this movie is great for kids, but also, again, like you were saying earlier about protecting them. And like, I don't know if it would work today with most kids. I think the wonder is still there. They just opened up a Academy Award museum here, and they've got some of this Labyrinth stuff sort of featured along with like Dark Crystal. And again, there's an appreciation for it for sure. I love that it took the risk. Yeah, I think it's a good 4 for me too. So it's definitely staying on my shelf. But yeah, Susie, thank you for helping me review Labyrinth. It went along longer than I thought, but that is what we do. That's what we do. So thank you all for listening. I hope you guys enjoyed sort of this retrospective of Labyrinth. And if you learned anything new, yay. If not, maybe you got some fun memories of listening to us talk about it. We'll be back in another 2 weeks. Susie is going to join me once again on the literal anniversary of Donnie Darko. January 19th is when this film was released, and you will hear our review then. So stay tuned for that. Remember, there are no such thing as a guilty pleasure film. You fuck those haters and enjoy and be proud of your taste in film. This is Movie Geek and Proud.